Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
It's good to be back here again. So, as I said, this month is a month where we consider different aspects of compassion. And the title that I gave, because you always have to come up with a title for the newsletter, and I tend to talk kind of extemporaneously. So it's kind of hard for me to come up with a topic and be able to stick to it. So if the contents change from the title, that's just the way it is. But in the title, I said we're going to consider equanimity, compassion, and the balance. What does it mean to keep our balance in these crazy times? So hopefully some of what I have to say will be useful for this. Equanimity, it's not the same as compassion, but it's one of the four Brahma-viharas, which are called the four immeasurables or four heavenly abodes. We don't practice them in Zen at all. We actually don't consider them really in Zen, but the three of the four Brahma-viharas are what's called metta, or loving-kindness. I like to call it open-heartedness. The second one is compassion, which is opening to the suffering of yourself and others and wanting to lean into it, wanting to make a difference in that suffering. And the third is sympathetic joy, which is the ability to rejoice in good fortune of others, which is not as easy as it sounds. I mean, most of us are happy when something good happens for a friend, but if too much good happens, it's like, you could dial it back a bit, right? So it's considered actually one of the most difficult ones to practice, is sympathetic joy. But those three are really quite different from the fourth, which is equanimity. And equanimity is the underpinning, actually, of all of them. Without a sense of equanimity, it's almost impossible to sustain compassion. It's almost impossible to sustain loving kindness. We tend to pick and choose the ones that are easiest for us to do if we don't have this sense of equanimity. So what does equanimity mean? There's several different aspects to it. And one of them, probably the most important one to remember, is there's only so much we can do about any given situation, right? We can control our own behavior, our own intentions, but not someone else's. Darn, right? Traditionally, there's a phrase that we contemplate when we're practicing equanimity. Cut out on me. Anyway, traditionally, this phrase is contemplated when we're practicing equanimity, and it says, "All beings are owners of their karma. Their happiness and unhappiness depend on their actions and not on my wishes for them." We don't actually need to bring karma into the picture if that term creates problems for you. It's just common sense, right? It is that what happens to somebody, whether they're happy or not, depends on how they're living their own life. There's only so much I can do to contribute to their happiness. And even if I do everything that I can, if they're not going to be happy, they're not going to be happy. They're just going to see things the way they see them. And yet, even though it's common sense, I can think of numerous times every day when I've tried to kind of wish somebody else into submission of my idea of what is best for them, my idea of what's going to make them happy, because it's going to make me happy, right? If it makes me happy, then everybody else is going to be happy. Right? I'm sure that's true for all of us, that over and over again, if we really observe ourselves, we see ourselves kind of trying to adjust people very subtly to fit our picture of what they should be. So that kind of leads into the one of the second aspect of equanimity, which is don't take things so personally. In other words, consider the other beings around you as well as yourself. They may have a very different perspective on things. It doesn't all look the way it looks from our perspective. It can look very different from someone else's perspective. And we need to be able to treat other people's perspective as equal to our own, at least, in terms of its value, in terms of its validity. And if we can do that, we begin to see that what are ups and downs for us may be the opposite for somebody else. So one of the practices that I really like to do with equanimity is called the eight vicissitudes or the eight worldly dharmas. And you may have heard this list before. This is gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and ill repute, pleasure and pain. And if you really think about it, these go up and down all the time. We may be having a great deal of pleasure. I'm eating ice cream, that gives me a lot of pleasure. I eat too much ice cream, now I'm in pain, right? I mean, these things change moment by moment by moment. Sharon Salzberg, who I train with, has written quite a number of books on these practices, loving kindness, and she says so many times people will contact her and they'll say, oh, this was your best book ever. And then the next email she'll get will be somebody saying, I don't really like this book, it doesn't speak to me. So there's that, praise and blame. What one person says just hit the nail on the head. Another person says, didn't really do it for me. It's the same book, same advice that she's written in the book. Different people feel it differently. So we don't want to take that so personally. It's hard, though. We'd much rather hear praise than blame, right? But if we can learn to see and not latch on to any one particular condition or any one particular situation, or that person always makes me angry, that person always has something to say that knocks me down. Well, that may be what we notice about them, but they may be very different in other ways. So if we can really practice with these eight vicissitudes or eight worldly dharmas, we begin to have a broader perspective on things. We see those ups and downs, the ins and outs of life, and we don't take anyone's situation and kind of globalize it. Oh, this is always going to be this way. This is never going to get better. So that's part of it, is to be able to see things from other people's perspective. Another point is we can never really know all of the causes and conditions that go into creating a situation. We may be able to identify some of them, but if we think that that's the whole picture, we tend to interpret the situation in a certain way. But if we're missing pieces of information about how things got to be a certain way, then we miss out on some of the ways in which we can be in that situation and be helpful. So, a real simple example is to just assume in Seattle there's a lot of people living on the street, just to assume that they're not pulling their weight in terms of making their lives work. Well, when you actually begin to talk to people, you find that there are people out there with college degrees. They may have gotten sick, lost their job, lost their apartment as a result of losing their job. They don't have health insurance. Their health situation has gone downhill. Just a whole cascade of things has happened based on something that really they have no control over. And that's true more times than you might realize. And yet we see this picture of people kind of dirty, disheveled, living on the street. They may be confused, they may be angry, there may be all sorts of things that we see on the surface that if we think about it, if we were in that situation, how would we respond? How would we react? So to be able to acknowledge that we don't know everything about anyone's situation helps us to have a sense of equanimity about it, not to reach a conclusion and then latch onto that. This is what's going on, so this is what has to happen to fix it. And following out of that, we tend to be perfectionists, you know. We tend to set unrealistic goals and standards for ourselves. It's like, well, we need to figure out a way to make that person's life easier, right? And we have a picture in our head of what that might be. And there's only so much, again, that you can do. If we set a standard for ourselves, if we set a goal for ourselves that's too high, we're not going to be able to sustain our efforts at compassion. And that's a really hard one for me to accept, actually. I tend to think I ought to be able to do more. I ought to be able to fix this situation. I ought to be able to make this person be happier. And part of what we're doing when we act out of compassion towards someone is not fixing them, not making the situation go away necessarily, but reinforcing the connection that we have with this person. Now, that connection may not be real good. It might be kind of confused. It might be what we would call a bad connection. If, for example, again, looking at somebody who's homeless on the street, perhaps they're dealing with mental illness and are not able to relate in the same way to me that I'm trying to relate to them. I might consider that a bad connection. If they think I'm going to hurt them, they're going to lash out at me. That may not be a good connection, but it is a connection, and it's something that we have to honor. It's something that we have to care for as well as we can. It's a hard one to accept. So oftentimes, as a result of this, we agonize over what's the right thing to do. If you're walking down the street and everybody has a little cardboard sign that says, need help, need a job, need money, please help out. They're asking for something that we're concerned about. If we give this person money, what are they going to do with it? Is this really going to be useful? I can't give them enough money to really make a difference. But I could give them a dollar, but what if they use it for drugs? I hear this a lot. It's like, should I give money to people who are asking for money on the street? And there's this phrase that's used sometimes called idiot compassion. Sometimes people think that that's what idiot compassion is talking about, giving money to a drug addict, for example. That's not what idiot compassion means. It's not about the nature of what we're doing, but about our motivation for doing it. So if we act, you know, as a way of kind of soothing our conscience, trying to make ourselves feel better, that's idiot compassion. That's when we're trying to make the problem go away. because it's upsetting us too much. That's what idiot compassion means. But if our motivation is really to in some way alleviate this person's suffering, that's not idiot compassion, if that's our motivation. And that's true regardless of the result. You know, maybe you give this person money and they spend it on drugs, or they spend it on something like potato chips when you think they ought to be buying broccoli. There's all kinds of things where we may judge what somebody does with that. But the point is, if we've given it with the motivation that this will make this person's life a little easier, then it's the correct motivation. Our daughter, Rachel, actually had some very profound thoughts on this. She's pretty generous and has engaged with folks on the street for quite a long time, and it's really instructive to go with her. And I asked her this question about what do you do when you're not sure what somebody's going to do with the money? And she said, well, first of all, I can't really judge that. She said, and I would rather assume that somebody is trustworthy and going to take care of themselves than to assume that they're not trustworthy and they can't make decisions for themselves. She said, I will feel better about meeting that person if I value them as a person. This is really a profound way of looking at it. She said, so I don't judge that. You know, if they spend the money, they spend the money. Once I give it to them, it's their money. It's not my money. So that's really not my issue, what to do. The other thing she said is, she always, and I've been with her when she's done this, she always introduces herself, hi, my name is Rachel, what's your name? She says, and then she'll have a conversation with them. And sometimes what will come out of that conversation is, they're trying to get enough money for a sandwich. Well, I'm going to Subway. Can I pick up a sandwich for you? What do you want? And so you begin to relate to that person as a human being. And really, the generosity is not about the dollar or the $5 or the Subway sandwich. It's about acknowledging, recognizing this person as a human being, acknowledging their value. And that's really much more important than the material size of what we might be giving, but holding that person in that way. I told a story for before the kids left. It's really not just a kid's story. It's a very good story for us to hold as well, to really consider what it means to take care of one starfish at a time, you know. You're not trying to save every starfish in the world, but this one, this one, this one. And there's a koan that I love. It's a great koan that kind of relates to that. And the question that's asked is, how many stars are there in the sky? The first thing that might come to our mind is, oh, an infinite number. Or if you're geeky, you might say, well, right, as of right now, they've counted so many, you know. But actually, the response that you want to give is something like this. 1, 2, 3, 4. Or this one, and this one, and this one, and this one. Each star has value. And there are many of them, but each star also has value. So it's that the paradox of this infinite number one at a time. And there's, if we can hold both of those aspects in our compassion, then we'll have a sense of equanimity about things. We see the broad sweep of things. We know that what we're doing is a small thing, so we don't have to be serious about it. It's not like the world is going to rise or fall over this one thing we do. And yet, we need to be doing it. The koan always reminds me of an exchange I had with my father many years ago, and some of you have heard me tell this story perhaps. But we were raised Quaker in an old Quaker meeting house that had been around for almost 300 years when I was a child. It was all the benches in the meeting house were the original benches, which was really neat to imagine 300 years of people sitting and meditating on them, so there was a lot of power in them. But as you walked in the aisle, of course, you'd run your hand along the top of the bench in front of you. So people would run their hand along the bench, and over 300 years, that top edge of the bench was polished so highly that even a small amount of light coming into the meeting house would reflect off of it. Of course, I was sitting here, so the top of the bench was right about my eye height, and all I saw was this reflection. And I asked my dad, I said, "Is that the inner light?" Quakers talk about this inner light that's inside of each of us that we're trying to bring out. I said, "Is that the inner light in the bench?" And he said, "Yes, it is the inner light." And he said, "You know, that these hands rubbing the back of the bench over time had polished it so highly that the light could shine through." That was what he told me. It wasn't a reflection, but the light was shining through. And he said, "We're like a pair of hands on the meeting house bench. You may not think what you're doing is making a difference, but over time, many hands make a difference." And I love that story. It's a noticeable difference. We could see it in the benches. And what it does is it reveals that compassion that is naturally inside of each of us. And we may not do it right. We may not think there's much of a difference. We may not think there's any result. We may think we're not skillful at it. And the person that we're trying to help may not appreciate it. They may be angry at us. All those things may be true, but it makes a difference over time. If our intention is to help, it makes a difference. In the Jewish tradition, there's something called tikkun olam, which is a way of saying the world needs fixing and it's our job to fix it. And in the commentaries, the Talmud, it said, "It's not upon you to finish the work, but you are not free to ignore it." So there's this sense of there's a huge job to do, but you can chip away at it, you can pick away at it, just don't put it down. So it's a sense of contribution to a greater effort, rather than it being a burden or a disaster that you have to deal with. And we need to be open to suffering wherever it might occur. So it's not like, well, I'll go do my thing now and then I don't have to think about it for the rest of the week. If we see something in front of us, we do what we can to help. But we don't wait for perfection. There's a G.K. Chesterton makes this comment. There's this expression that you hear often, anything worth doing is worth doing well. And I love this. He said, anything worth doing is worth doing badly. Or we might say, anything worth doing is worth doing, period. You know, don't worry about how well you can do it. Just make the effort. Of course, there's plenty to do. And coming back to that initial question I have is, what do we do? How do we live in this crazy world? You know, we may be overwhelmed by what's happening in the environment, in our political situation. And I think it's important, and here's where equanimity comes in again, is have some balance about this. Let's not obsess about what's going wrong. In other words, let's not saturate ourselves with the news. Don't make yourself listen to it all the time. It's going to make you crazy, right? Listening to it five times a day isn't going to change either the situation, but it is going to wear you down. So we don't need to do that to ourselves. Those are the ways in which we can care for ourselves and pay attention to some of the other things that are going on in the world that aren't necessarily reported on the news. Pick something and do that. Don't feel like you have to do everything. Again, don't panic. And also examine our intention. If we're acting out of anger or a sense of superiority or a sense that something is wrong and needs to be fixed, in that we have the, we know the right way things should be, and that's not that way. So that if any of those things are going on, we're separating ourselves from the situation we're in, and that's really not the intention that we should have. It doesn't mean that we have to like or agree with what's going on, or even acquiesce with what's going on. We can be very firm and clear and still be acting in a compassionate way. That doesn't mean we don't set boundaries, but the intention is absolutely key. The intention of how we act is absolutely key. That we're going to help and not, at least not cause more harm, not add to the anger that's out there. So we complete that action, that moment-by-moment action, and then let it go. Offer it up to the world as, okay, here's what I can do right now in this moment. So we keep coming back to the, really, the most important aspect of equanimity is we can only control our own actions and intentions, not someone else's. And we can only act in each moment, one moment at a time. So these, and yet we act knowing this connection, feeling this connection, feeling the broader picture, the ups and downs, and not getting so worked up about each particular rise and fall.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.